Good afternoon. My name is Sherry Joan, and I'm a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, Penn State Dickinson School of Law, and School of International Affairs, I would like to welcome you to the Winfield C. Cook Constitution Day Address, Understanding Today's Threat Environment, a public address by the Honorable Michael Chertoff, former United States Secretary of Homeland Security. The annual address is endowed through the generosity of Winfield C. Cook, a former Dickinson trustee. Each year, the Clark Forum invites a prominent public figure to campus to speak on a contemporary issue related to the Constitution. The event celebrates the United States Constitution while commemorating Dickinson's connection to our founding charter through John Dickinson's participation as the original signer. Previous Constitution Day speakers include George Marjorie Orendel, Kenneth Starr, Jeffrey Stone, Governor Tom Ridge, and Erwin Chemerinsky. The Honorable John E. Jones, who will introduce tonight's speaker, is an alumnus of both Dickinson College and Penn State Dickinson School of Law. Judge Jones began his legal career as a law clerk to the President Judge of Schuylkill County, the Honorable Guy Ebo. In 1995, Jones was appointed chairman of the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board. In 2000, he received the Government Leadership Award from the National Committee Against Drunk Driving. President George W. Bush appointed him to the District Court of the Middle District of Pennsylvania in 2002. In 2007, Judge Jones presided over Kitzmiller v. Dover, an important case which dealt with teaching intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in public schools. He was named one of the 25 most influential graduates from Dickinson College in 2007. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session following Secretary Chertoff's speech. Because this event is being taped and some audio members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. A book sale in the lobby will follow today's presentation. Secretary Chertoff's book entitled Homeland Security, Accessing the First 5 Years will be available for purchase. And now, please join me in welcoming the Honorable John E. Jones.
Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction, and it is my honor and privilege to introduce our 2011 Constitution Day speaker this afternoon. Some time ago, Professor Pullman asked me if I had any ideas for a 2011 speaker. I immediately suggested Secretary Chertoff because there was an obvious link there to the 10th anniversary of 9/11, of course. But more than that, I am familiar with the arc of Mike Chertoff's career. His is a compelling life story that features academic brilliance, dedication to public service, and vigorous patriotism. Mike Chertoff graduated cum laude, magna cum laude, from both Harvard College and Harvard Law School. He clerked for a United States Supreme Court justice, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do, to achieve. That was Justice William Brennan. He then followed that service in private practice for a period of time and went to work as a prosecutor for Rudy Giuliani, who was then the United States Attorney for Manhattan. He made a name for himself in that job dealing with political corruption cases and did so with distinction. In 1990, he was named United States Attorney for the District of New Jersey, his native state, by the first President Bush. He continued his public corruption-busting ways in that office and was successful to a degree that he was asked to stay on for a period of time by President Clinton, which again is not unprecedented but is rare in the world of federal prosecutors. In 2001, Secretary Chertoff was appointed to the important position, a vital position, of Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the United States Department of Justice. And this appointment, as it turns out, could not have come at a more critical time in the nation's history. In this job, as it turned out, Secretary Chertoff investigated the attacks of 9/11. He was one of the principal authors of the Patriot Act as well. Additionally, Secretary Chertoff remained on the front lines of corruption busting as he formed the Enron Task Force to successfully prosecute those who committed the massive corporate fraud in a ruinous scandal that ultimately brought down that corporation. And those prosecutions did result in a number of very high-profile convictions, as some of you know. My first personal contact with Mike Chertoff was in the fall of 2002, when he came to speak, as you recall, at our Third Circuit Judicial Conference. It was about a year after 9/11. It was during a time of both great unease and uncertainty in the United States. I distinctly recall watching him speak, being impressed by Mike's firm resolve to keep our country safe, and I further recall that I was quite certain after watching him speak that he had the entire skill set to do it. What I didn't know at that point, and I suspect what he didn't know at that time, was that in less than 2 years, President George W. Bush would appoint him to a prestigious seat on that very same Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And for those of you who do not know this, those who don't come from the law, when a federal judge is appointed and confirmed under Article 3 of our Constitution, he or she is able to serve for life. It was thus very fair, given the prestigious position that then Judge Chertoff, had achieved, to assume that in that post, that post would be the capstone of a remarkable career. If you had made that assumption, however, you would be in error. In February of 2005, Judge Chertoff was asked by President Bush to give up that lifetime commission on the Court of Appeals and to return to the executive branch as the second Homeland Security Secretary in our nation's history. As is his custom, when called to serve, Mike Chertoff accepted this burden and thus cut short a most promising career on the bench. Now, in that vein, I speak from experience, since as an appellate judge, he had occasion to review my work as a federal trial judge. And in preparation for today, I confess that I didn't look to see whether you reversed me. I'm pretty sure that you might have, but I'm also pretty sure that you let me down easy. His opinions, and I can say this now because he's not reviewing my work anymore, were masterful, they were clear, they gave good guidance to those of us on the trial bench, and we miss him as an appellate judge. So he gave up that life commission. He became Secretary Chertoff, and he served in President Bush's cabinet with great distinction until January of 2009. Now, I know a little something about the department he oversaw, and I stress little because of my personal friendship with his predecessor, Tom Ridge. And many have debated, and I'm sure Secretary Chertoff many times debated, whether the department is too large. It is a complement of almost 220,000 people and a budget of $50 billion, too unwieldy. But in these jobs, as Secretary Chertoff also well knew when he took the job, you play the hand that you're dealt and not the one that you might prefer, and he did that very ably. And his success, I would submit, was resounding at the end of the day. And he accomplished much in the area of border security and cyber strategy. But at bottom, as is the primary responsibility, I believe, and I think most believe in that job, he kept us safe during his time in office until leaving in January of 2009. When his time at Homeland Security concluded, Secretary Chertoff returned to the private sector, where, among other endeavors, presently he's formed the Chertoff Group, a global consulting firm, and he serves as well as a senior counsel to the law firm of Covington and Burlington in Washington, D.C. He has a number of other affiliations, really too numerous to name, including boards and still public endeavors that he's involved in. So as we celebrate the 224th anniversary of our Constitution signing this week, I couldn't imagine a better speaker than Mike Chertoff, someone who has dealt with the Constitution in every conceivable way. To him, the Constitution is not an abstraction, and it's not merely a concept, but it is a document with which he has had an intimate relationship, a practical relationship, at each and every stage of his career. Although oft repeated, I could not think of a better way to finish this introduction, the introduction of our speaker, our distinguished speaker tonight, than to quote President Teddy Roosevelt, who said, somewhat famously, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena." Mike Chertoff has been in the arena for some time, and he has served there, as I said, with the highest distinction. Ladies and gentlemen, I am very honored to present to you our speaker tonight, an American patriot, Secretary Mike Chertoff.
That's really lovely. Thank you very much. All of you take comfort. I'm putting my watch up here, so I'm mindful of the time. That was a great introduction, Judge, and you know, it reminds me of the scene in Tom's Huckleberry Finn, I think, where they think Tom Sawyer has been killed, and he goes and sneaks into the church and hears his own eulogy. And usually, you have to wait till you're dead to hear nice things said about you like that. So you really, you kind of made my day. There's one additional piece of the story about the time that Judge Jones and I first met, which was at this judicial conference in 2002. He left out to tell you that it was in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. That's because St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands are actually part of the Third Circuit, a fact not known by many people but cherished by the judges of the court who get to sit down there. And at the time, I had actually been approached about the possibility of becoming a judge, and I was thinking about it. And the then chief judge, the late, great Edward Becker, who was a marvelous chief judge, always skillful, invited me down to speak. And afterwards, my wife and I kind of assumed it was kind of like a recruiting trip. It was like, come down, this is what it's like on the circuit. You're on the beach. It's in St. Thomas. You know, good food, good wine. So it worked, and I signed up. But then I left 2 years later. Well, I'm delighted to be here to celebrate this Constitution Day and also to be one in a line of very distinguished speakers, not the least of whom was my predecessor, Tom Ridge, who was also the former governor of Pennsylvania, and someone who deserved a lot of credit for standing up the Department of Homeland Security. He was in the White House and involved in doing the initial architecture of the department, and then, of course, he took the helm as the first secretary, excuse me, and he had to really stand up the department from scratch. There was literally no premises, no fixed premises. The various components were scattered in different parts of Washington. Ultimately, he was able to set up shop in an old naval installation, which itself had been converted from a girls' school many years ago. Footnote, it was one of the places where they did code breaking and broke some of the, you know, famous codes of World War II. And he had to really build from the ground up. So I was really fortunate in being able to follow him. And I consider him someone for whom both I have a great deal of admiration and friendship as well. This year, we celebrate the Constitution in a year which actually marks a couple of important milestones in our dealing with the issue of terrorism and the conflict with terrorism. One milestone is it is the 10th anniversary, or shortly after the 10th anniversary of September 11th. The other milestone was the operation, the successful operation to eliminate bin Laden in May of this year. And although in a real sense, in a real world sense, that death of bin Laden didn't end the struggle or the conflict. In fact, in many ways, it may have made it more challenging. Still, from a kind of an emotional sense, it allows us to look at the first 10 years almost as if they have bookends in a symbolic way. And what I'd like to talk a little bit about is the fact that actually that bookending is really just symbolic, that what has been more significant in those two events in and of themselves is what those events reflect in terms of the changing nature of the security environment in which we live and the kinds of threats that we face. I've argued and I've said before, I don't think 9/11 actually changed everything. I think what it did is it revealed that everything had changed and we just hadn't noticed it. Terrorism, obviously, even with respect to Al-Qaeda, goes back into the 1990s. Bin Laden used to take credit for playing some role in the infamous episode of Black Hawk Down where we were chased out of Somalia. In 1993, there was an attack on the World Trade Center. As it happened, I was involved in that investigation because I was the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. And while there were only relatively few casualties and the buildings themselves were not structurally damaged, that was unquestionably the first blow on the part of al-Qaeda to strike at the United States. And in fact, the nephew of the architect of 9/11, who was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his nephew was Ramzi Youssef, who was the architect of the 1993 World Trade Center attack. There's a story told that after Youssef was found somewhere else in the world a couple years later and he was rendition was taking place, meaning they just took him and took him back to the U.S. to stand trial, that as he was flying in over Manhattan to go to the land at the place to be taken to jail to be held, one of the agents pointed to the World Trade Center and said, "You see, it's still standing." And Ramzi Youssef said, "That's because I didn't have enough explosives." So that's kind of a chilling reminder of what the precursor of this was. Then, of course, we had the 1998 bombings of the embassies in East Africa. There was an abortive effort in the mid-90s to blow up tunnels and bridges leading into Manhattan. That was the blind sheik, who himself was a refugee from Egypt, where he'd been chased out for being an extremist. And then the Kohl bombing in 2000. So there had been a lot of terrorist attacks, and in fact, the declaration of war by al-Qaeda in 1998. And yet, in terms of our security strategy and our security doctrine, we still lived very much in the old world of the Cold War. And that was a world where security was viewed as neatly divided into two parts. One part was war, and we knew that because that involved big nation states with armies and uniforms and missiles and tanks and ships. And then we had crime, you know, local security issues. And that could be international, but we knew that was different because they didn't wear uniforms and they didn't have big explosions. They didn't kill a lot of people. And so what we did when we dealt with security strategy is we divided it depending on whether it was in the category of war or crime. And if it was war, we sent the Department of Defense and the intelligence community at it, and we had different kinds of tools and weapons and rules of war and doctrines. And if it was a criminal problem, if it was a transnational gang that was dealing narcotics, that was different. That was the Department of Justice, that was prosecutors, that was courts, that was a different set of doctrines. Here was the problem that was revealed with that vision in the last decade of the last century and the first year of the new century. And that is that it no longer reflected reality. The rise of globalization, the ability to travel and communicate and send money around the world, and the leverage of technology, the ability of small groups of people to cause enormous amounts of damage, changed our conception, or should have changed our conception, of what security threats were. It was no longer that war could be waged only by a nation state. A network could wage a war. A global network could wage a war. And it no longer was true that the destructive power of a state was qualitatively different than a destructive power of a network or a group, because the number of people killed on 9/11 exceeded that in the United States on any single day in our history. It was comparable to the worst days of battles we had in the Civil War. So to argue that it was qualitatively different than the kind of consequences of war making simply was belied by the facts. And this change in the way the security architecture evolved after the Cold War was something that only really became manifest to us on 9/11, when we actually saw it play out. But as I've said, I think that really the change had occurred before then, and all that happened is we woke up. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, of course, we have the death of bin Laden. But reflect upon the fact that al-Qaeda never was a unitary organization. It was a movement. Al-Qaeda comes from the Arabic word, the base. And the original conception of al-Qaeda was not only to be a single organization, but to be a seeding ground, kind of venture capital for terrorist organizations with a like-minded extremist ideology. So there were groups of similarly oriented and ideologically affiliated terrorist cadres that would train with Al-Qaeda, that would be funded by Al-Qaeda, but might not necessarily fully take the oath to be obedient to bin Laden. So the network concept was very much part of the original notion of Al-Qaeda. And that's why when I say the death of bin Laden doesn't mean the bookend of Al-Qaeda, it's because it was always more than just a single leader, although the elimination of that leader has symbolic importance and also achieves a measure of justice. In fact, what we see is a very successful campaign waged over the last 10 years to eliminate or incapacitate the leadership of Al-Qaeda, but then a growing new leadership, one that spreads out, one that may be younger, one that in many ways may be more challenging because, unlike bin Laden, who in many respects seemed to want to replicate 9/11, you know, find another 9/11, another big event, the new cadre may not really feel that that's necessary. They may be willing to experiment with different kinds of terrorist tactics, doing multiple small-scale attacks, similar to what we saw in Mumbai in 2008. You know, among the two in the next generation of leaders that I worry about in Al-Qaeda are Anwar al-Awlaki, who you've all heard about, who's in Yemen, who has really built Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the Yemen version of Al-Qaeda, into a robust, self-sustaining a terrorist organization. But another guy you probably didn't hear of is a guy named Adnan Shukrajuma. He was living in the United States for many years. I think his parents actually still live in Florida. And we chased him. He was a fugitive for years because he was a trained pilot. And our belief was that he was going to be part of planning and carrying out the next wave of aviation attacks in the wake of 9/11. So you have people like Awlaki and Shukrajuma, both of whom lived for years in the U.S. and who understand American mentality. That is the face of the next generation of terrorism. To make matters more complicated, and again, my theme being here that this old binary system of categories, war versus crime, military versus police, that's no longer really reflective of reality. To make things even more complicated and, frankly, more disordered, we see the rise of homegrown terrorism. That simply means the strategic decision by terrorist groups that it has now become sufficiently difficult to move their operatives from overseas into the U.S. that it's more efficient to recruit people in the U.S. and turn them into operatives when they're in place. And using the internet, using the fact that Americans do travel overseas, and we've had a number of instances where Americans have gone to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they've wound up getting recruited and radicalized and trained, and then they come back. Using those operatives, the thought has been our defenses will be bypassed, that they'll be able to come back to the U.S., they won't have criminal records, we won't have intelligence about them, and then in the fullness of time, they will try to carry out attacks. We saw that in 2010 with the Times Square bombing. We saw it with Nidal Hassan, who was radicalized in place, and then shot and killed over a dozen people in Fort Hood. And we continue to see attempts like this. And again, this challenges our categorical thinking about this, because it turns out that the threat of international terrorism isn't only arising overseas, it can arise in our own backyards and our own neighborhoods. And that means, again, thinking about how we deal with it. How do we collect information? How do we prevent things from happening? It's no longer just a matter of sending our overseas assets, our spies and our satellites out in order to figure out what the enemy is planning. We've got to engage local communities and local police and local citizens because much of the activity may be occurring here at home. And you see the See Something, Say Something campaign, which started in New York City. That's one of the manifestations of that strategic change. So, again, the delineation has been collapsed, and we now have to look 360 degrees for where these threats might be. Another challenge is the rise of what I call ungoverned space. Ungoverned spaces are areas in the world where there may or may not be a nominal government, but if there is, they don't have complete control over all of their territory, and they don't have the will to enforce the control that they do have. The classic example of this, of course, is Pakistan and Afghanistan, where we still see the Taliban and other extremist groups operating with a relative degree of safety. That has changed over the years. They've been feeling more pressure. But nevertheless, there are areas there that are essentially not firmly in the control of central governments. When those areas fester and flourish, they become locations where you can build recruiting camps, you can build training camps, you can experiment with laboratories to come up with biological and chemical weapons. That's what they were doing. The 9/11 Commission report indicates they were doing in Afghanistan prior to the invasion. And what we've seen with the rise of ungoverned space is it spreads. We have it not only in Pakistan and Afghanistan, it's increasingly true in Yemen. There are parts of North Africa which are, relatively speaking, ungoverned. And these all are areas which are fertile for the development and the growth of terrorist groups with extremist ideologies. How do you deal with that? Is that a law enforcement problem? Is it a military problem? What are the tools we should use? What are the agencies that ought to get involved? The answers we thought we had 10 years ago don't really tell us. And it's my belief, actually, we're in an all-of-the-above situation. We've got to use all the tools. And that means we've got to rethink some of the ways we've thought about the appropriate role of various agencies as we go forward over the next 10 years. Now, it's hard to talk about all this without discussing the amazing phenomenon of the Arab Spring, so-called Arab Spring, which, of course, has resulted in toppling Mubarak in Egypt, in apparently coming close to toppling Gaddafi in Libya, elections in Tunisia, Yemen, not really clear what's going to happen there, and Syria in the middle of a rather bloody insurrection that's being suppressed. How does this turn out, and what is the impact of this on our terrorist challenge? Well, in one way, it's very hopeful, because much of the argument or the narrative that the terrorists made was that the social and economic problems of the Middle East and Southeast Asia and South Asia were a result of the fact that the countries had strayed into the domain of the West, that they had abandoned their religion, and that the true path was an extremist, fundamentalist version of Islam, which is probably not an accurate version, but nevertheless, the ideology took the mantle of Islam and claimed that this extremist fundamentalism, that was the way to achieve a better society. And of course, the Arab Spring suggests that there's an alternative path, one that involves democracy and the rule of law and freedom. The problem is we don't know how it turns out. And it's great to be hopeful, but it's unwise to let hopeful thinking become wishful thinking. It may be quite a while till we know the answer to the Arab Spring. And it may, by the way, turn out to be different answers in different countries. It's a big mistake to lump them all together. There's a story, I believe it's told by Henry Kissinger, that many years ago he was in China with Zhou Enlai, and they were talking, and he said to Zhou Enlai, "What is your view of the Chinese Revolution so many years later?" And Zhou Enlai said, "Too soon to tell." And so then Kissinger, being mischievous, said, "Well, what's your view of the French Revolution 2.5 centuries later?" And Zhou Enlai said, "Too soon to tell." And in many ways, that's true. It's too soon to tell. We don't know how it's going to turn out. Some of these countries may become, in fact, reasonably democratic countries with a rule of law and fundamental freedoms. Some may lapse back into military rule or other kind of dictatorship because the new government isn't able to sufficiently develop itself to actually begin to deliver to the people what they expect, which is, after all, a decently running economy, a certain amount of law and order, and a regularity of society that allows people to go about their business. You can't run a country from the town square. At some point, you've got to be able to have investment, security, economy that works, and jobs. And if that's not provided by the first round of post-revolution governments, you could get a second or a third round, and that could become a military government. Or it could swing in the direction of the extreme Islamist fundamentalists, those who have a political, ideological agenda, because they are well organized. Those of you who studied the Russian Revolution in 1917? No, there were two revolutions. There was the Menshevik Revolution, which began as a kind of a social democratic revolution, and there were the Bolsheviks, who ultimately supplanted the Mensheviks and moved it into hardcore Leninism. So we have a lot to watch. We have a lot to be hopeful about. Our ability to control these events is limited because these have to develop organically. At the same time, you know, we have gotten ourselves engaged, and we would be silly not to recognize our national interest will be affected by how these things turn out. As I take you around the world and look at security and talk about, in particular, where the threats come from, I don't want to suggest it's only about radical Islamist extremist fundamentalism. That's one part, one group of people with a particular ideology, and I hasten to make clear this is by no means a reflection on Islam as a religion or most Muslims. This is about a group of people who have self-described themselves as Muslims, have picked, you know, the language that they want to pick to support their ideological view, and then have blended it with some other historical things like, you know, some of the Western totalitarian ideologies, and they've got their own ideology. But apart from that, we have other threats to deal with as well. If we look in our own hemisphere, the Mexican government now is involved in a difficult struggle with organized criminal cartels that actually challenge the government for the control of some of the northern cities in Mexico, those that are on the other side of our own border. And, you know, you've seen stories about the tactics that these cartels use, which, by the way, are taken right out of what you could see on television or on the internet about what was happening in Baghdad or in parts of Afghanistan. Beheadings, torching people, blowing people up with car bombs, killing innocent people. All of that stuff, which is terrorist tactics, all this has been adopted by these drug cartels with a very simple terrorist mission: to convince the central government and the population of Mexico that it is not worth enforcing the law in northern Mexico and that they should make peace with the cartels, where the cartels basically get to run the cities that they want to run and they leave everybody else alone. That is a huge potential problem for Mexico. It is also a problem for us because the prospect of having, again, what I call ungoverned space, a matter of miles on the other side of our border, is one that ought to fill us with a certain amount of apprehension, because that could become a platform for some very dangerous activities, not only smuggling, but potentially violence as well. And by the way, those who study the history of the United States know that there's been a rather fraught relationship over the centuries between the U.S. and Mexico, particularly when there's been cross-border criminality, and I think Pershing went in 1918 because of Pancho Villa. So 1915, 1916. So we've had this issue before. We don't want to have it again. But if you look further down in other parts of Central America, you'll see again, you have increasing situations where countries like Guatemala, Honduras, do not have the capability to fully control the international drug gangs that are within their own borders. And lest you think that the drug gangs, again, that's criminality, it couldn't possibly get into war, we've had the experience of criminal gangs and terrorist groups getting together. We saw it in Colombia when the FARC, which was the revolutionary terrorist group, began to create a relationship with the narco-traffickers. First, what they did is they would charge the narco-traffickers for protection. And then pretty soon they got involved in actually helping to bring the drugs up north. We see that phenomenon now in North Africa, where there is reporting that drugs from South America are sent into parts of North Africa in the sub-Sahara region, that they are staged and protected by Al-Qaeda in the northern part of Africa called Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and then they're sent on to Europe to be sold, and the terrorists get a cut of the proceeds. So this, again, has to make us concerned about whether some of these threats from transnational groups in ungoverned space could begin to morph into a more ideological threat. You know, it doesn't take a lot for a criminal gang leader to look into the mirror one day and say, you know, I'm not really a thug. I'm actually a political revolutionary. And then, of course, that opens up a whole new set of concerns. Finally, let me talk about one other set of threats that are not in the real physical world, but in the cyber world. And I'm sure you've read all about this. It's been increasingly in the news, but that only reflects, I think, the tip of the iceberg. Some study estimated that in the last decade, $1 trillion of intellectual property has been stolen through the use of cyber attacks that penetrate networks and steal valuable intellectual property. We've had the phenomenon of denial of service attacks, including one in 2007 on the country of Estonia, launched from Russia, and one in 2008, which accompanied Russian troops when they invaded the country of Georgia. The first was, you know, the Russian government said it wasn't us, it was just some gangsters. The second clearly was part of a military campaign. So we've seen the possibility of cyber attacks being actually part of war making. And we've seen huge amounts of criminality in cyberspace. Millions of credit card numbers stolen and then exploited to be able to rob financial institutions or other companies or individuals of considerable sums of money. This strikes at one of the major elements of our current global economy, which is the ability to conduct transactions over the internet. It erodes trust in the internet. It actually, in many cases, steals money and damages our economy. The theft of intellectual property has enormous consequences on our competitiveness as a country. And of course, the example of the 2008 Georgia War ought to make us reflect upon the possibility that a foreign state or a terrorist group or even a group of extortionists could decide to disrupt or destroy a cyber system for critical infrastructure in a way that could be devastating and could be comparable to the kind of economic damage we saw on 9/11, if not an actual loss of life itself. So the challenge of dealing with this compounds the difficulty I've been talking about all along about how do you organize your thinking about security threats. After all, you could view an attack on our cyber, on our critical infrastructure as an act of war. I think it would make sense to do so. Oddly, that act might not come directly from a foreign country, though. It might originate in a foreign place, but hop around the world so that ultimately it was launched through servers that were being remotely controlled, located right here in the U.S. Is that a criminal problem? Is it a military problem? Who deals with it? Is it the FBI? Is it the Army? Is it some combination of the two? Likewise, you have in parts of the world, particularly those where cybersecurity is not very robust, the possibility of literally thousands or tens of thousands of computers being turned into a botnet to mount an attack against either a facility or a company or another network. Now, how do we deal with that? Do we take action ourselves to incapacitate that? What do we do if all those servers are in another country? Do we take those servers down? Is that an act of war that we're committing? Do we have to give fair warning? I mean, there are tons of very complicated questions about strategy and doctrine and law that emerge in particularly acute form when you think about the issue of cyberspace. So where does all this take us? I leave you with this thought, that if you go back historically, like 1,000 years, the concept of war was very different than it was in the last 100 years. Everybody thinks about war as like World War II. Tanks, planes, everybody's in a uniform, naval battles, and certainly something that requires nations on both sides. But if you go back 1,000 years, we had wars between tribes, there were wars between barbarians and countries like the Roman and empires like Rome. There were religious wars. Most of the wars of the middle part of the last millennium were driven not by national affiliation, but by family relationships and religious beliefs. So it's nowhere foreordained that what war is about is nation states and uniforms. That just happens to have been the way war has taken place in the last 300 or 400 years. The next 300 or 400 years may be back to what we had a millennium ago, which is wars conducted based on ideology and belief with networks that are not necessarily geographically bounded, but are bounded by family relationships or affiliation, or even simply by common outlooks cultivated over the internet. And that means that we're going to have to rethink our strategy and our doctrine and our investments in security to deal with this new world of threats that doesn't fit in these handy categories we've gotten used to. As with most areas, the period of maximum danger is when you've gotten so accustomed to viewing the world through a particular prism that you never recognize that the prism is no longer there, and you have to think outside of it. And the great thing about being in college or in law school or in postgraduate studies, where I think many of you are, is you have a great opportunity not to necessarily start thinking about things through the traditional prism, but to look outside the prism, think outside the box about what the challenges are going to be. They're going to engage not just those in uniform, but those outside of uniform, because most of what occurs, both when you deal with terrorism and when you deal with cyber issues, occurs not on battlefields, but it occurs in backyards and offices and in your homes. And that means most of the assets and most of the people who are on the front line are civilians. So that whole idea that there's a big difference is going to change, and maybe it will be back to what it was at the time of the Constitution, which is we'll all be, in a sense, part of a citizen militia. Not in the sense that we'll all wear uniforms, but that we will all have to take some ownership and responsibility for security. It will not just be something we can outsource. It'll be something we all have to have participation in. So I'm delighted to talk to you, and I'll be happy to take questions and throw it over to Andrew.
We will now begin the question and answer session. Please raise your hand if you have a question.
Over the last decade, the United States has created and expanded an enormous intelligence and military establishment. How far down that road do we go until you could call this a police state? And what safeguards do you see that are in place or that should be in place to prevent that?
Well, first of all, I think some of the conventional wisdom or conventional something about expanded defense and intelligence, some of that is actually based on an exaggeration. I know there was a piece or a series of pieces in the Washington Post that, you know, came up with some startling figures about the number of people who have security clearances and number of buildings where intelligence activity occurs, without bothering to mention that if you are dealing with an intelligence agency, everybody from the cafeteria staff to the night cleaners has to have a security clearance for obvious reasons. So it doesn't quite translate into quite as big an expansion as said. I guess I'd make a couple points. First of all, I think there's a budget limitation, which I think is an inherent limitation on how much we deploy in this area. But I also think beyond that, I'd be hard-pressed to actually see a huge change in the civil liberties of people in this country. In fact, I think if you compare the 10 years after 9/11 with the period after, during and after the Civil War, during World War I, and during and after World War II, what's actually striking is how modest the impact has been on civil liberties. There are no newspapers being closed down. People aren't being thrown into jail because someone disagrees with their political opinions. yes, it's a little more cumbersome to go through the airport, but that's a reality of dealing with the challenge of ubiquitous terrorism. The fact of the matter is that there are people who are getting more and more skilled in building smaller and smaller bombs and who want to kill innocent people. And that's a reality. I mean, you might complain about the growth of the medical establishment because there's disease, but there's disease. You've got to deal with it. I think the courts generally have supervised what's gone on, and sometimes they approve it and sometimes they disapprove it. And the great thing about this country is whatever the outcome of the court decision is, you never hear anybody suggesting they won't follow the decision. All the decisions of the court, you know, people might appeal them, but at the end of the day, when the Supreme Court gets the final word, that gets followed. So, you know, I guess I would say that while there's some impingement on our security, and there's certainly, you know, more information that's collected, I would argue that much more invasion of privacy has occurred through the voluntary activities of people getting on Facebook and Google and unbelievably opening themselves up to, following all of their activities for nothing more than commercial purposes. There's no higher value here. It's just in order to sell you more junk. I would think that's, frankly, a much bigger problem. I think we are not likely to find ourselves anywhere near a police state.
Hi. I was wondering, you talked a lot about kind of now with this new threat, which organizations are going to be taking responsibility for that? Will it be the FBI? Will it be the CIA? Will it be the military? And I'm just wondering, after 9/11, when, you know, I guess as part of the Patriot Act, the wall between the CIA and the FBI came down and there was open communication, how do you think the higher chains of command will affect that? It seems like as more kind of national security organizations come together, they lose power overall, and if things will slip through the cracks, or if you think it's actually going to be a benefit.
Well, I do think there's much better coordination, cooperation, and exchange of information now than there was 10 years ago. I mean, part of that was eliminating some arguable legal problems. Part of it was really a cultural change. I think people felt shocked and horrified that they might have missed the ability to connect the dots and prevent something. And I think that remains. There's always a tendency on part of organizations to kind of pull back to control information, not necessarily because people are have ill will or bad motivation, but because sometimes they don't understand the significance of the information to somebody else, or simply because their mission is one which they want to carry out, and therefore their inclination is to believe they do things the best. And it's very difficult sometimes to get people to acknowledge someone else might actually be better at doing a particular mission. So, but I think what is required is a constant pressure from the leadership to make sure not just that you're sharing, but that you're thinking about what pieces of information might mean. And this is a very hard thing to do because you get into the crying wolf syndrome. You know, after you've had your 1,000th threat report, you know, daily threat report, it's not quite as shocking as the first one. And it takes a lot of discipline to, A, not overreact to everything, which is as bad as underreacting, but, B, to be able to separate when something really warrants, more significant response than something else. And that's part of the need to constantly train and inspire people to recognize that they have a lot of responsibility. You know, when you look at the screeners at the airport, looking at a lot of bags going through, that is kind of mind-numbing. And part of what they have to try to do is motivate people, to remind them, you know, in a lot of different ways, that while it may seem repetitive, almost like an assembly line, one of these times you're going to find something in a bag, and this has happened, which ought to raise a serious question in your mind. And so that problem of keeping people sharp is not just organizational, but it's a question of leadership as well. Okay, PJ.
Terry, good to have you here. If we could engage your biography a little bit from Assistant Attorney General to Judge to Secretary of Homeland Security, and you talked about the frame, which is somewhat unresolved still, the tension between war and crime. That manifests itself also in, you know, once a terrorist suspect is captured, does he go into a civilian system? Does he go into a military system? We've had instances in recent years where in the Bush administration, Jose Padilla was captured here in the United States and initially felt would be prosecuted through the military system. The court said not so fast. You had the Obama administration wanted to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to New York. The Congress said not so fast. You've had a recent instance where a terrorist suspect was captured in open waters and for a period of time was debriefed on a Navy ship, but then brought into a civilian system. How do you see this playing itself out? What is the best model or perhaps hybrid for us to be able to deal with, you know, bringing justice to these people, but within a under the rule of law?
So, well, I think you're right when you say it ought to be hybrid. And I'm going to reverse what you said a little bit, because I do think this is important. In this area, this is not about bringing justice to these people. It's about preventing further bad things from happening. Now, that doesn't mean that you can do anything that Katie barred the door, but it means that you're in the ordinary criminal justice thing. You know, you have a robbery or murder or something bad. What you're doing is you are bringing justice to the victims and bringing justice to the defendant, and it's all about justice. In war, it's not about justice. In war, it's about winning. And this is really a hybrid. That's not to say war doesn't have rules and laws. There are things you can't do in a war and things you can do. But war itself is not about law and justice. It's about winning the battle. So I would argue that because we're in a hybrid situation, you've got to take a practical approach. And I think if you see the, in the Bush administration, the general approach was, the presumption was, if you were caught in the U.S., you wound up going into the ordinary civil court system. If you were caught overseas and you were not an American citizen, you wound up going to the military system. But there were some exceptions. There was an exception for Padilla. So there was always the ability. Now, the reason there was a presumption was because, for civil liberties purposes, we're nervous about having a president being able to go around the U.S. and point to people and say, you're going in the military system instead of the criminal justice system. So we want to make that an unlikely event and create a high presumption against it. But recognize there might be a reason that you have to do it in some circumstances. Likewise, when you're dealing with war fighting overseas, the idea of bringing lots of foreign enemies into the U.S. is logistically and legally an unappealing option. But there might be some circumstances where you want to do it. So you want to have a certain amount of balance and a certain amount of flexibility in moving back and forth, provided that each of the systems, you know, gives you fundamental fairness. And I think, you know, clearly the criminal justice system does, and I think the military commissions are, you know, fundamentally fair, but some people may disagree with it. And if you want to argue about that, you can argue about that. I do think I want to come back to that main point, though. I spoke at a law school recently, and the lawyers were talking about how we have to think about counterterrorism in terms of, you know, how we apply justice and how we deal with defendants' rights. That is not the main reason we are engaged in counterterrorism conflict. It is not so we can have lots of lawyer activities and new lawyer shows involving, you know, a CSI Miami. It's about doing the kind of thing we do in a war, which is to prevent people from killing large numbers of Americans. We did not fight World War II with the argument being we want to bring the justice system to the enemy. We ultimately did it. A judicial process afterwards. But the main point of World War II was to win, and to do that, dare I say, we did some very rough stuff, including two atomic bombs and some very heavy carpet bombing of major cities in Germany, because it was not about justice, it was about winning a war. So to me, and I want to be careful, I'm not saying we don't play by rules and have laws, but the purpose of the exercise to me in dealing with international terrorism is not about bringing justice to victims and defendants. It's about preventing these organizations from being able to do substantial damage to our country and our friends.
Good evening, and thanks for being here. So you're talking about the new era of globalization that we're facing, and thus the issues of terrorism and drug trafficking and intellectual property, etc. But my question is about the paradigm of the threat to environment. on homeland security. And so we have, you know, everything from soil, air, water quality concerns to social concerns through the impact of, for example, energy extraction, and people see this as a threat to their homeland, and also through the impacts of all these emissions and damage to the environment to climate change, and thus the impact of the increasing number of disasters into the arising all over the globe, from hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes. I mean, we saw all three of those in Carlisle just in the past few months alone. So what is the paradigm of the environment in homeland security definitions, and why isn't it seen as a significant security issue?
Well, you raise all kinds of interesting, important questions about the environment. And the question is, why isn't it a homeland security issue? And the answer, I guess, for me is, if everything is a homeland security issue, then nothing is a homeland security issue. Everybody has things they're concerned about which are serious and important things. Environmental issues are serious and important. Economic issues, jobs, the economy, competitiveness are important issues. You can couch them all by using the word security. You can know about environmental security, economic security. In the end, though, that becomes unwieldy, becomes almost impossible to talk about. I used to try to be pretty careful to say that when we talk about national security and homeland security, we're talking about protecting people against willful acts of violence and against person and property by other people, as opposed to, you know, natural disasters. I mean, that's part of homeland security, but that's more of a consequence of the fact that it's organized to cover natural disasters, but it's not, strictly speaking, national security. Economic security, environmental security, all important things that probably have trade-offs, to be honest. And so, you know, I mean, I was Secretary of Homeland Security. There was someone above me who made those trade-offs called the president. Within my domain, I didn't have to worry so much about those trade-offs. I had to trade off within the very considerable competing goals within my own agency. So, look, these are all important issues. And there's an argument these days, and it's got a lot of merit to it, that we have to temper our investment in national security, you know, in the interest of economic security. Because if we bankrupt ourselves, we're in a very bad state. There's a lot of merit to that. Now, that's easy to say as a generality. You got to get into the specifics about, well, exactly where do you make the trade-off and how much risk do you take on both sides of that? That's true with environmental stuff as well. You got to trade that off against jobs.
Excuse me. Good afternoon. I have a question about the death of bin Laden, and in the aftermath, it has been said that due to the fact by the previous administration, it was dubbed as the war on terror, and one can't exactly win a war against terrorism because terrorism is ongoing, as you yourself said. Do you believe that it would be in our best interest to focus on counterterrorism tactics instead of uniform planes, tanks, bombs in foreign countries? Do you believe that our best interest would be in counterterrorism instead of war itself?
So I think you're adverting to the debate about whether you do counterinsurgency or counterterrorism. And first, let me say, by the way, I don't want to be misunderstood, that killing bin Laden, although I don't think it ends the issue we're in, was hugely positive. I also give the president great credit for making a very courageous decision to do it, because there was a lot of risk. If it had gone the other way, it would have been a very bad outcome in a lot of ways. So I give him a lot of credit for that. I'm not an expert in this, or others, particularly probably some here from the Army War College, who can really do a great job of debating the two. I think the challenge is this. It comes back to that issue of ungoverned space. I don't think anybody's particularly interested, for the sake of itself, in trying to build little mini constitutional Pennsylvanias in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. I think the concern is that you want to create conditions on the ground that will not simply invite a repeat of what we dealt with in 2000, when we had the Taliban there basically being hospitable to extremists. You know, if you talk to Pakistanis and people from the region, including government leaders, they almost all of them, interestingly, will tell you that one of the major grievances they have against the United States was that after the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan, we basically checked out of the area and we lost interest. And they felt that what was left was a disordered Afghanistan with a lot of violence, no functioning system of government. And then ultimately the Taliban came in and they said, we'll give you government and justice. It may be cruel, but it'll be fast. And that's how they wound up taking over the country. So what you wouldn't want to see happen is to revert to that. And then we'd be back in the same space we were before. That being said, it is very hard to know how to make that transition, because ultimately it is the people in the country that have to want to do it. And, you know, the challenge, I think, for us is what worked in Iraq worked in Iraq. Iraq was a different society. And even that's not perfectly done, but at least it's kind of a reasonable facsimile. Afghanistan's different. Different culture, different ethnic makeup. Whatever we do has to be adapted. Maybe that means a less centralized focus and more of a localized focus. And here you're getting out of my area of expertise. But I would be reluctant. Here's what I don't think. I don't think you will succeed simply by using a pure counterterrorism strategy. I think if the Taliban came back and occupied the cities, the idea that we would prevent the growth of terrorist groups there by using, you know, special forces and drones is not realistic, particularly because they'd be in the cities themselves. And it's very hard to target in a city. You know, the operation in Abbottabad against bin Laden was a brilliant operation. And there are many brilliant operations being conducted by our special forces. But you don't want to count on that being 100% perfect, you know, thousands of times. That's a lot to ask, and also creates a whole separate set of problems about collateral consequences, which are difficult. But listen, a hard question.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi. I would be curious to hear what you think about the threats kind of all over the spectrum that you were talking about in the next 10, 20 million years, however many the world has, how the United States needs to or can work with other countries. Just your thought on multilateralism in general, or whether the United States needs to go at this one-sided, because we've almost taken that stance in the past 10 years, and I wonder what your thoughts are on involving the international community.
Okay, well, first, I hope the world's going to be around for more than 30 or 40 years. I mean, that's, you know, I think is, I find the contrast, actually, between administrations often much exaggerated in the press, and there's much less than meets the eye when you actually look at it. The Bush administration was not as unilateralist as some people say, and I don't think the Obama administration is as multilateralist as people say. What do I mean by that? Clearly, you know, there's a lot of debate about Iraq. I don't even want to, that's like a whole separate speech and discussion. But we did a lot of work with other countries on counterterrorism from 2001 through to the end of my tenure and continuing on into my successor's tenure. A huge amount of intelligence sharing, common activity with the Europeans, with countries in the Middle East, a great cooperation. And that has continued pretty much the same under both presidents, with different secretaries of Homeland Security and different secretaries of defense. So I think there's always been an element of multilateralism and cooperation. Now, is there a place for unilateralism? Well, I mean, the Bush administration used to talk, and maybe talked a little too much, about how we're willing to do what we have to do by ourselves. On the other hand, if you look at the attack in Abbottabad with bin Laden, again, which I want to be clear, I applauded. I think it was great. But that was unilateral. No one asked for permission. This was not a country that is in the zone of battle. It is a country which has a functioning legal system and with whom we have you know, decent relations. Sometimes they're hotter, sometimes they're colder. I don't think that, maybe I'm wrong, but I doubt there was a lot of debate about people saying, let's take the indictment we have of bin Laden and send it over to Pakistan and say, we found him, arrest him, and extradite him back. That would be the multilateral approach. Nor, apparently, did they say to the Pakistanis, why don't we go in together? They, as reported in the news, which is all I know because I wasn't privy to it, they did what they had to do, and then on the way back, they called up and said, hey, by the way, we just killed bin Laden in your country, a mile away from the Army War College of Pakistan. That would be like if bin Laden was here in Dickinson College near the Army War College, and the Pakistanis came in and killed him and then left and told us about it. So I think the answer is unilateralism has its place, multilateralism has its place. The idea that administrations are strongly, you know, are one or the other, I think is a myth. And I always like to tell my friends in Europe, they're always shocked to find out that when there's a change in government in the U.S. and change in party, actually, when a president actually gets the job and has the responsibility, pretty much Americans tend to be quite aligned and bipartisan in terms of fundamental security issues. You don't find a lot of huge variation, contrary to what, you know, some people outside seem to think you get.
Thank you. You mentioned many of the current crises or challenges that the United States faces at home and abroad. That being said, do you think the United States is safer now than we were before 9/11?
Yeah, I think we're hugely safer now. I mean, first of all, the scales have been dropped from our eyes. We do understand now that the nature of the challenge we face and that it is different than the Cold War. We have done a lot institutionally and strategically to reduce our risk. It doesn't mean the risk goes away or that there's a guarantee that nothing bad will happen, but it means that we have reduced the risk to a reasonable level, recognizing that to reduce it further would wind up starting to impinge on our liberties and our freedom in a way that's unacceptable. But then we have to accept that. We have to, you know, if there is, God forbid, a successful attack, we can't go, oh my God, why didn't we, you know, inaugurate a police state? We've got to say, no, we made that decision, and we obviously want to go back and see if there are some tweaks we can make, but we don't want to revisit our fundamental values. So I think we are a lot safer. I think we only got to have one issue to be concerned about, which is the one advantage that our adversaries sometimes have over us is they have long memories. And they are very dedicated and persevering. And they don't get impatient, and they don't want to move on to the next topic. And that perseverance can become a powerful tool if we're not able to continue to stay focused. It doesn't mean we all have to be focused every minute. It does mean, though, that we, A, have to invest in professionals who will stay focused and give them the tools to do that. And B, we all do have to play a certain part in this process. There, you know, this see something, say something thing, which is really a little bit about civic engagement, I think is an important part of how to deal with this. You know, about a year after 9/11, Attorney General Ashcroft had a similar program. He talked about how people should report things that they saw. And by the way, there was amazing intelligence. People who really... some of the cases that were made came because individuals called up. But I don't think the country was ready at that point for that message, or maybe John Ashcroft wasn't the right messenger for that, and there was kind of a negative reaction to it. I think now there's a kind of a second round where 10 years later, and maybe because of the homegrown terrorism, people are a little bit more concerned about what's going on in their backyard. I do think this idea of civic engagement and preparedness is an important part of the strategy. Well, thank you guys for great questions.
Thank you, Secretary Chertoff, and thank you for coming to tonight's presentation. Just want to remind you that there's a book sale in the lobby of ATS. Thank you.